Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, it was announced this week that a very intimate journal found in the writer Joan Didion's home will be published in April, and it's called Notes to John. John is the name for husband, the writer John Gregory John. And it apparently recounts sessions that she was having with a psychiatrist starting in 1999 for a few years. So it'll be the first new material from Joan Didion since she actually stopped publishing work in 2011, 10 years before she died. So writer and Joan Didion fan Adele Coffey joins me now from our Galway studio. Hi, Adele.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Good, thanks. So before we get to these intimate diaries and whether they should even be published, give us the cheat sheet first. Who exactly was Joan Didion?
So she was a writer born in 1934 in Sacramento in California, but is quite associated with New York as well. She was a bi-coastal writer, really, but she came to fame with her first collection of essays, which was called Slouching Towards Bethlehem. And it chronicled the kind of chaotic scene and quite a dark scene in California, particularly in the Haight-Ashbury area, the hippie scene, a lot of drug addiction, a lot of negative outcomes of that, obviously. And it was this kind of capturing of the zeitgeist that was so acute and so insightful. It made her a literary superstar. Before that, she had published just one novel, and it had kind of entered into the world unnoticed. And this suddenly, she was this superstar. And there was a series of photographs taken that people, even if you've never read Joan Didion, you might know these photographs. They were taken by a photographer called Julian Wasser for Time magazine. And it's just this unbelievably cool woman in a long dress, sandals, leaning against her Stingray car and holding a cigarette, and just couldn't get cooler than it, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, she remained very cool and glamorous all her life, didn't she?
Yes.
So in terms of why she's so revered as a writer, she went on, she kind of had various phases then. She wrote for the movies at one stage. Mm. There was as a kind of an essayist slash reportage, and then the memoirs as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she was unusually successful in all areas. She was a reporter. She was also an essayist. And I think that's kind of her main legacy, is the essays, the personal essays. She was also a novelist, and she considered herself a novelist first and foremost. And then herself and her husband, who was also a writer, John Gregory Dunn, they wrote scripts for the movies when they lived in L.A. They wrote, they did the Barbra Streisand A Star Is Born. They did, I think it was Al Pacino's first movie. So they did a lot of very successful movies. And earned a good living from that too. She would have entered really into the kind of common vernacular with her memoir about John Gregory Dunn's death in 2005. The book was published. He died at their dinner table, just a massive heart attack. And she wrote The Year of Magical Thinking, which was her memoir about grief, about losing him suddenly. And that went on to be a Broadway play performed by Vanessa Redgrave, who is a very close friend of Joan. Like, Natasha Richardson got married in Joan's apartment, her first husband, she got married to him. So she had this very sort of glitzy celebrity life. She knew a lot of actors, she knew a lot of rock stars, she knew a lot of writers, obviously. And she was famous for throwing huge dinner parties. And just for somebody who presented as so incredibly shy and retiring, she also had a very, very social and glitzy life.
Yeah. But then kind of known, I suppose, isn't she, for casting a cool eye over everything and for her kind of unflinching clarity, maybe.
Yeah. And that's part of her appeal as well. And it's funny, there's been four biographies released since her death in 2021, which tells you something about the appeal of her mystique and her allure and how sort of unknowable she presented as, you know, there was that mystique there always, and she kept people at arm's length, even though she was writing personal essays. But she was kind of considered what would have been considered a male writer in a way. You know, she was so cool. She was so cold-eyed, very exacting in her language. She was a huge fan of Hemingway, and she actually said that when she was a teenager, she used to type out his writing so she could learn how the sentences worked. And that obviously played a big role in the kind of writer she became. She was just very clear-eyed. And I think the difference between her and a lot of the sort of new journalism writers of the time, like Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer, and even people like Hunter S. Thompson, was that she seemed to have this, it was kind of a supernatural ability, I think, to engage with the zeitgeist she was living in from an almost futuristic point of view. Like she could see the big picture while she was still in the picture. And they just described, I think, she actually, she analysed, she saw the kind of the impact and the outcomes or the possible outcomes. And so
in,
she was
in
able
real
to,
time, yeah.
She was able to define the zeitgeist in real time.
So tell me about these diaries. What do we know?
So what we know of is that they were written, they were sort of descriptions of her sessions with her psychiatrist, and they deal with subjects of anxiety, depression, guilt, her fraught relationship with her daughter, who was her adopted daughter, Quintana Roo, who actually, in such a tragic way, died, I think it was like the week or the month that her memoir about her husband was released. So she was an alcoholic, she died of pancreatitis, and she had had a lot of health problems in the years following or after her husband died. So there was there's a lot about her relationship with the daughter apparently in it. There's 46 sort of entries. And her literary executors, who include her agent and two of her longtime editors, they think that she intended them to be published because they were collected together, printed out, they're in an envelope or in a folder, and they're in chronological order, which they take to mean that she would have intended them to be at least read by the public in her archive, if not published. So I think they're going to be seen as a third installment in that grief triptych that would include The Year of Magical Thinking and Blue Nights, which was the one about her daughter. So I
some
think
people
it's
are
control
questioning,
from the grave.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
or
look,
from beyond the grave.
She was nobody's victim or never to be manipulated, you would think. But people are questioning, oh, well, is this too intimate and everything? But then, like, I suppose she was brutally emotionally honest in that later work, like in Blue Nights, about Quintana's life and death as well, wasn't she?
Yeah, like she was and she wasn't. That was the great trick about Joan Didion. You know, you thought she was exposing herself, but she never was, actually. She would tell you intimate things, but you would still feel that you didn't know her. And maybe she was telling you intimate things about her daughter and her husband, and so therefore you felt you were learning intimate things about her. But I think her image was so carefully constructed. There's a brilliant new book by Lily Ann Nolick, I think her name is. It's called Didion and Babbitts. It's about Joan Didion and Eve Babbitts, who was a kind of artist in LA at the time. And in that book, she describes very clearly Joan's early, unfamous life, you know, before Slouching Towards Bethlehem came out, when she was having an affair with this womanizer, essentially, called Noel Parmentel, who is the main male character in at least three of her novels. And he was the man that she always loved, apparently, the man that she had her first real sort of sexual awakenings with. But all of that is erased from Joan's version of the story.
Okay.
So
okay.
She just had this seamless progress to a literary superstar, according to her version of events. He was completely written out.
So this could be the last, her last trick, the great reveal, do you think?
Yeah, it's so controlled, so cool. And the fact that they were left there in that envelope and addressed to John, which is where the name comes from, of the title of the book, about notes to John. I do think that she was unbelievably controlling in terms of her image. She decided what she presented. She, you know, initially she was described as this mouse of a woman, a really shy person, but actually she used those sort of cliches of her gender, the idea that she was this fragile little woman and she was a very tiny person. And she used those to completely exploit people to get the story she wanted, to get the help she wanted, to get people to help her. She was voraciously ambitious. And there's no way that this material was left without any kind of intention. She was far too controlled and far too
Well, we're all liberated to buy it, so, because we feel it's what she would have wanted. Adele Coffey, thank you very much. That was fascinating.